Well, good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and this is SCARS, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SCARS organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCARS server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by Kilo Bravo 8, Zulu Golf Lima, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such, and all stations will be worked in the order in which they've checked in. Information regarding our operation may be found at scarsvoip.com. SCARSVOIP.com. Your net control for this session is actually KB9EWG. I am merely opening it up. My name is Kathleen. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and I'm located in the city of Port St. Lucie, Florida, where it's currently a temperature of 82 degrees. We had a high of 87 and absolutely no rain. So prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If so, come aboard.
Hello, Kathy. This is Fred, K2HA. And it's not an emergency, but if you will permit it, I'd like my wife to say hello. This is K2HA.
Go ahead, Fred, and welcome to your wife.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Kathy. This is Colleen Schramm. I'm interested in dogs, and we have two dogs, and I'm thankful that you're having this, and I look forward to listening. Thank you.
All right, super, and welcome, Colleen. And I'd like to extend our condolences to you and Fred about your latest puppy that left this world. But you do at least have two, and I think you'll enjoy the program. And I'm very appreciative of Fred for bringing you here. So very, very much welcome you. So how about anyone celebrating their birthday this week? Or maybe last week? So is there anyone anywhere that's going to be another year older? Well, it looks like we're not getting older, and that's probably a good thing. This is the monthly Thursday Informational Net Open Forum, or TIN for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and other areas of general interest in those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. Now, let me advise you that if you've talked this evening, you'll most definitely be part of that recording, and it'll be put on the website as a podcast. So hopefully you enjoy the program this evening. The topic is training and use of service dogs, and it's being presented by KB9EWG, who I think is in the process of training a service dog. So with that, I want to welcome anyone that has come aboard. A special welcome to you, Doug, out there in California, and Paul, my ex-partner, welcome as well. So with that, I'm going to throw it your way, Dave, and enjoy, and I'll be listening in the background. KB9EWG from Kilo 6 Sierra United November.
Well, Miss Sunshine, Kathy, thank you so much for that wonderful intro. It definitely is a pleasure to be here this evening, and it's topic that's near and dear to my heart. And yes, I am in the process of training a service dog at this point here. In fact, I was just out with him training about an hour before Nut started, doing some training with him this evening. Anyways, good evening to everybody. This is KB9EWG David in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Echo 2289 is my South Cars number. And yeah, as Kathleen said, this is the Thursday Information Net, and we are talking about training and using of service dogs. Before I get into the heart of the subject, I would like to kind of give a brief history here of how this whole thing got started here. So let me reset. Okay. Back in June, I had a little Yorkie terrier as my pet dog. And early part of June, he crossed the Rainbow Bridge, as we say. He became deceased. And a couple days later, a friend of mine got me involved with a group called Paws for Independence. Paws for Independence trains service dogs and assists people in getting service dogs. And I became involved with them right after my Yorkie had passed away, and started working and volunteering with them, training other dogs. And then on August 21st, I actually received a dog of my own. It's a one-year-old black lab male, and he is now in the process of being trained to be a service dog himself there. And the way this program works with Paws for Independence is they'll match you to a dog, and then they'll train you and the dog together. The handler and the dog will be trained together, so you bond and learn together in the whole process, which I think is an excellent way of training the service dogs. So anyways, that's kind of a brief history of how this got going, because I talked to Fred a few times here and talking about the training and everything else, and then I was asked if I'd like to give a talk on it. So here I am, talking about training and using service dogs. So good evening to all. I'm going to start with some definitions on that. Let me reset here. Okay, first, you'll find on the South Cars webpage, there are four links on there. And the links you will find would be the training, the CGC test, or good citizenship test, loyalty, and rules. And I'm going to start with the rules of the road. I'm not going to read the entire thing, just some brief definitions here to give people an understanding, and we'll go from there. So let me reset here before I start off. Okay, an overview. The public provides guidance. Okay, this publication provides guidance on the term service animal and the service animal provisions in the department's new regulations. And this is under the American with Disabilities Act, by the way. Beginning on March 15, 2011, only dogs are recognized as service animals under Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA. A service animal is a dog that is individually trained to work or perform tasks for a person with a disability. Generally, Title 2 and 3 and titles must permit service animals to accompany people with disabilities in all areas where members of the public are allowed to go. So let me reset and continue on. So how is a service animal defined? A service animal is defined as dogs that are individually trained to work with or perform tasks for a person with disabilities. Examples of such work or tasks include guiding people who are blind, alerting people who are deaf, holding a wheelchair, or alerting and protecting persons who have a seizure. Reminding a person with a mental illness to take prescribed medications, calming a person with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, during an anxiety attack, or performing other duties, services, and service animals are working animals and they are not pets. The work or tasks a dog has been trained to do provide must be directly related to a person's disability. Dogs whose sole function is to provide comfort or emotional support do not qualify as a service animal under the ADA. And this is one area that a lot of people have confusion with the terms service animal and emotional support animal and therapy dogs, and I'll go into that further. Let me reset here. This definition does not affect the broader definition of assistance animal under the Fair Housing Act, or the broader definition of service animal under the Air Carrier Access Act. Some state and local laws define service animals more broadly than the ADA does. The information of such laws can be obtained from the State Attorney General's office. Now, there is another provision in the laws for miniature horses. Let me continue on there. I'll reset. All right. The miniature horses, in addition to the provision about service dogs, The department's revised ADA regulations have a new separate provision about miniature horses that have been individually trained to do work or perform tasks for people with disabilities. Miniature horses generally range in height from 24 to 34 inches measured at the shoulders and generally weigh between 70 and 100 pounds. And titles covered the ADA must modify their policies to permit miniature horses where reasonable, and the regulations set out for assessment factors to assist entities or entitled in determining whether miniature horses can be accommodated in their facility. The assessment factors are: 1. Whether the miniature horse is housebroken; 2. Whether the miniature horse is under its owner's control; 3. Whether the facility can accommodate miniature horses' type, size, and weight; and 4. Whether the miniature horse is or its presence will not compromise legitimate safety requirements necessity for a safe operation of the facility. Let me recite it. So let's look into further where service animals are allowed. Under the ADA, state and local governments, businesses, and nonprofit organizations that serve the general serve the public generally must allow access to service animals to accompany people with disabilities in all areas of the facility where the public is normally allowed to go. For example, in a hospital, if it would be inappropriate to exclude a service animal from areas such as patient rooms, clinics, cafeterias, or examination rooms. However, it may be appropriate to exclude service animals from operating rooms or burn units where animals' presence may compromise a sterile environment. Service animals must be under control. Under the ADA, service animals must be harnessed, leashed, or tethered unless these devices interfere with service animals' work or the individual's disability prevents using these devices. In that case, the individual must maintain control of their animal through voice signals or other effective controls, such as use of a clicker or possibly a control collar. I'm going to stand by and see if anybody has any questions or wants to check in at this time. This is KV90WT with the Thursday Information Net.
6, Victor.
Okay, KY6D, go ahead.
Well, number one, thank you very much for putting on this program tonight. It's one that I'm very interested in, and I think there's a lot of people that share their interest with me as well. I've gathered from a number of sources several questions that I'd like to throw out for everybody's benefit here as we go through the program. But let me start with one that is sort of germane, and the question reads, David, how do most people handle the cost of a new service dog? It's the understanding that the overall cost is high, you know, somewhere between $15,000 and $30,000, and can be as high as $50,000. My goodness gracious. What options do these people have? Do you care to touch on that, sir? KY6V, over.
Yes, I'd be more than happy to address that. Okay, the organization I'm working with, Paws for Independence, they work a little differently than what a lot of your service dog agencies will work. They, instead of taking a dog, training it, you know, and it could take up to about a year to 2 years of training a service dog. So they take this dog and train this dog in their facility, then bring in a prospective handler and match the dog up to the handler, and give it, you know, they spend a week or two together to bond together and to learn how to work together. Then turn that person loose, and these, and as you said, they can cost between $15,000 and $50,000. The organization I'm working with, Paws for Independence, they will take and match you to a dog, and then they'll give you this dog, and then they'll begin the training process, and they'll train the handler and the dog together. And they don't charge for the dog, but they do charge for the training services, which is a, I believe their fees are right about $4,500. And they do have ways of getting grants for these dogs. It could be covered under a person's insurance if they qualify. And, of course, there are ways of raising funds there, like GoFundMe and other ways of doing that. So there are many ways of getting, you know, getting funded, getting these dogs funded. So does that help you there, Gordon?
Yeah, it sure does. Thank you for that, David. I was hoping that there were grants available. I suspect that sometimes there's probably a long wait in that option approach. Are there any special loan organizations that have a somewhat low interest rate that people can utilize too? Along those lines, David, over.
Well, I know that was one thing that we discussed in a meeting the other day at my doctor's office, trying to discuss my funding my dog. You know, and it was mentioned about the grants, as I said, and there are, and I think I might have to actually get a grant for mine, because it's not looking very good, like the insurance is going to cover him, but there are ways of, like I said, getting grants and raising funds. And yes, I know Paws for Independence, she did mention a payment plan that's available also. Either low or no interest there, and it's you know, fairly reasonable payments per month. But like I say, you know, they don't charge as much as some of these other agencies. It's about $4,500 for the training with this program I'm in. KY6B, KB90WG.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, I don't want to monopolize things here. But you touched on a couple of other points. You know, there's other expenses, obviously, that the owner and master needs to take care of. The housing of the animal, the feeding of the animal, the veterinarian care of the animal, and on it goes. While we're on this subject, let me ask you this. Are there insurance policies that you can take out on a service dog? Health insurance to start with, you know, for veterinarian coverage, that kind of thing? Or, I'm talking reasonable. I'm sure you can insure anything if you got enough money, but I'm talking about reasonable type policies, David. Over.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of knowledge of this as of yet. I haven't really done a whole lot of research on that. As far as there is animal health insurance available, and I've considered looking into that there. But right now, you know, I've had a lot of other expenses, so it's been kind of difficult for me to think about. One of the first things I had to do when I got my dog Cole was, since he's just turned a year old and he's going to be a working dog, he had to get neutered, and I had to have that done. Fortunately, through the local Humane Society, they got a program for assistance for people with low income called the Spay Neuter Assistance Program, or SNAP, where I only had to pay $100 copay to have him neutered and also get all his shots and everything, his rabies shots and everything else up to date. So I had to file for a voucher, and I got received that voucher, and just had to pay $100 to have him neutered, so that was an expense out of my pocket. And yes, food and care and everything else is a lot of my expenses also. Like I said, there are ways of raising funds, like GoFundMe and that, though. You could actually try to help offset some of those costs, and I'm considering that once I actually get things more underway with this log here. Hopefully that helps you there, Gordon, KB90WG.
Yeah, these aren't all my questions. You know, they've been funneling in here as we've been advertising the program, so I'll get the word back to those that prompted some of these. Okay, thank you, David. I've got more on the list here, so I'll get back with you later. KY6V, over.
Okay, real good. And happy to answer any questions. So is there anybody else with any questions or wish to check in at this time? Let's take a standby for check-ins. This is KB90WG.
Sierra Echo Zulu.
November Foxtrot Foxtrot.
Okay, I can take them two by two. Good evening to SEZ and NFF. Any comments or questions from either Sierra Echo Zulu, KB90WG?
Thank you, David, and thanks for doing this TIN tonight. November 1, Sierra Echo Zulu here, Paul in Connecticut, and I just had a couple of comments. One was that I find the whole notion of service dogs who have the ability to alert to their owners when they're about to have a seizure absolutely fascinating. I admire all the other things the service dogs can do for us, and dogs can do for us in our lives in general just by being who they are. But that one to me is absolutely astonishing and fascinating. And the other thing I wanted to mention was too that what a wonderful and selfless thing this is that you and others do, who train these service dogs. Because I know that you love dogs, as do I, and you have to spend an awful lot of time working and loving this dog, only to then turn around and hand him over to someone else. It's going to be part of someone else's family. So it's a really wonderful and selfless thing that you do, and anyone who does this kind of work. And that's it. I'll be listening in and enjoying the net, and thank you again. November 1, Sierra Echo Zulu. Back to you, David.
Well, thank you. I believe it's Paul there. Good evening once again. I appreciate the comments there. Now, Cole, the dog I'm training, is going to be my service dog. I am in the process of trying to get him covered with insurance and all that. I am training him to be my dog, but I do work with other dogs as well and help train. I am a volunteer with the program as well, so appreciate the comments there. And they are trained to do alert procedures, and I've seen some excellent demonstrations at our training. There's one dog there that's actually trained to detect if a person is having a diabetic low and alert. And retrieve a treat for this person, like a banana or something like that, if they're having a low. And that's something I have seen in class demonstrated. What they'll do is when this gentleman's having a low, they'll take a cotton ball and swab them, any sweat beads or anything, and preserve the scent. And they'll use that to train the dog detecting the scent there. So that's a good thing. So, thank you, Paul. And NFF, Doug, good evening to you. Any questions or comments from you there?
Well, good evening, Dave, and everybody else on the net. This is Doug, N6NFF. I don't really have any questions, but I do have some comments, and that would be my wife, Sheila, N6IKB, is a guide dog user, but she is unable to be here this evening, so I thought I would stand in her stead and talk for a little bit about guide dogs that are used by blind people. And although I don't have one, I've been married to Sheila for 10 years now, and I've seen her with her guide dog and can tell you somewhat about it. Sheila has a guide dog that is 7 years old, and he answers to the name of Rufus. R-U-F-U-S. He is a black lab, and he was gotten from a school called Guide Dogs for the Blind, which is located in the San Francisco Bay Area, San Rafael, in Marin County, to be exact. Guide Dogs for the Blind was started in 1942 during World War II to serve as a place to train blinded veterans, of which there were many, to use a guide dog. And after the war was concluded, the Guide Dogs for the Blind became a school for civilian uses as well. Now, you were talking about, Gordon was asking about the financial situation. Guide Dogs for the Blind does not charge for their dogs. They give the guide dog to the handler for free of charge. They also pay for the person's training from contributions from private donors. If someone is coming to the school from across the United States, they will even pay for the student's travel expenses. Let me reset the timer. It used to be that the training program for training a person with a guide dog, they do it in much the same way as you were just describing, Dave. They match a prospective handler with a dog, and it used to be that the training session lasted 4 weeks for someone who was getting a dog for the very first time, 3 weeks for subsequent dogs that you would come and get. But they've narrowed that down to 2 weeks now, which Sheila Fields is not a really good idea, because you really can't get to know the dog in 2 weeks. But that is what they do in an effort to save costs and in an effort to make the classes smaller so that each handler can get more attention from the instructor. Guide Dogs for the Blind, I should mention, actually has two schools. They have the one that I mentioned in San Rafael, and then they have another one, which is in Boring, Oregon, and that's up by Portland. But they do not charge a student for the dog. There is another school in Morristown, New Jersey, called the CNI. In fact, I think they were probably the first guide dog school in the country. They started in 1928. And they do charge for the dog. They charge $150. And if you give them $150, you own the dog. If you don't have $150, they will let you pay as little as $1 a month until you have reached that $150 plateau, and then the dog is yours. Let me buy a nickel again. I'm not sure about all of the each of the school's policies concerning the veterinary bills. There are quite a few guide dog schools here in the nation, and each of them has different policies. Guide Dogs for the Blind, it used to be pretty liberal about paying the veterinary bills, but they've kind of tightened up on things a bit. This past May, Sheila's dog had to go in to have a molar removed because it was bad and it had to come out. And he also had to have some blood work done. Because the school knew in advance that this was going to have to happen, they were willing to pay the whole cost of the vet bill, which turned out to be around $1,500. And then we paid for the subsequent blood work that needed to be done, but that was only like about $30 or $40. Every year, Sheila takes Rufus for a physical and to be looked at by the vet. And sometimes the guide dogs will reimburse us for the vet bill. Other times they won't. It just depends. So the school always sends the form in, and then the guide dogs decides whether or not they want to actually pay that bill. Now, with regard to feeding, Gordon kind of touched upon that. Sheila is responsible for buying the dog, the dog food. They do not pay for that. I'm not sure what other schools do, but they will not pay for it. So you have to pay for that out of your own pocket. At one time, we were on Social Security supplemental income, Sheila was, and the state of California would give us $50 a month toward the care and maintenance of a guide dog. But we're no longer on that, so we no longer get any kind of a maintenance check from the state of California. But if you are someone who is working and at one time used to receive Social Security benefits, you might be able to stay on your benefits to a point anyway. If you have a guide dog, you can claim the care and maintenance of it against your Social Security check, and they will keep you on. But that is usually answered on a case-by-case basis. We really like Rufus. He's a great dog, and we're not sure how much longer he'll be able to work, but Sheila's going to work him for as long as she can. He's a very quiet dog. Let me reset the timer. Rufus is a very quiet dog, and he is the perfect apartment dog. He doesn't bark, and we live in an apartment, so that is a very good thing. And Dave, you were talking about dogs that can help with low blood sugar for diabetics. Although Sheila's former dog, Betty Lou, was not trained for that, often she would know when I would have a low blood sugar attack, and she would come over and lick me, and she would stay beside me to let me know, hey, Papa, you've got something wrong. You need to fix it. Your sugar's getting low. And there were a couple of instances where Sheila would want to take Betty Lou out for relief, but Betty Lou wouldn't go because I was having a low blood sugar attack, and she wouldn't leave me until she was sure that I was over my low blood sugar attack. So, yes, dogs can be used for diabetic alert dogs. And at one time, a lot of schools were using German Shepherds for dogs. Sheila had two Shepherds, because she's had a total of six dogs now. But the general consensus is a lot of schools, the great majority of them, use Labrador Retrievers or Golden Retrievers. There is a guide dog school in Ohio that uses standard size poodles, believe it or not. They are very, very smart dogs. I don't know that I would want one because of their curly nature, you know, the curly hair that they have. They would be very high maintenance, but they have proven to work very, very well. A friend of mine back in Columbus, his wife has a poodle, and she likes it very much. That's all I've got. If anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to entertain them, but I do have to leave at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So I'll send it back to Net Control, and hope you enjoyed what I had to say. This is N6NFF.
Okay, Doug, thank you very much. That's useful information, and appreciate you adding to this. The other person that I was going to have with me this evening, who has more experience with his service dog, couldn't make it this evening, so I just so I'm basically on my own with this part here. But I got plenty of information I can definitely answer questions and everything else with there. So, but thank you for participating. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net, talking about the use and training of service dogs. Anybody else wanting to check in or have any questions at this time before I continue?
Six Victor, sir.
GSN.
Okay, we got GSN and Six Victor. Six Victor, go ahead with your recheck.
Yeah, thank you, David. KY6V, and hello to Doug out there. Thanks for coming by. Good information, Doug. Answers a lot of questions. And, you know, pursuant to what he was just saying, sort of folds into one of the other questions that was given to me, and that was basically, what is the tenure of a service dog? Effective use tenure is what I'm talking about. Do they need to be retrained at certain periods of time in the length of time that they're with an owner? Number one. And number two, what is the period of time that they should be thought about being retired? I hate to use the term put out to pasture, but to be relieved of duty. David, KY6V, over.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good. Well, from what my from what my understanding is, if they start from a puppy, you could be looking at about a expectancy of about 10 years as an effective service dog. As they start to age and slow down and everything else, you know, they might not be able to perform as well. Then it might be considered time to retire. And service dogs do get retired, and either the handler who has the service animal will become its, you know, it will become its pet at that point. And they'll bring a new service dog in to take the place of the former service dog, or you might return the animal to the place you received it from, and they can pass the dog on to somebody else as a family pet and retire it. Now, that's probably going to be the hardest part about having a service dog to me. Would be when it comes time to retire and move on to a new dog, or in the event that that dog should become deceased, or as they say, cross the rainbow bridge. But good question there, Gordon. I said, and as I said, the information I've been given is from about a puppy. If they started as a puppy, you could probably expect about a good 10 years as a service dog. Hopefully that answers your question there, Gordon. KB90WC.
Yeah, you hit it when you said approximately 10 years. Gives me a little bit of perspective. You know, let me throw one other one in and then let you go across the pond here and pick up the gentleman on the other side of the Atlantic. You said two dogs. You know, you keep one dog as a pet because he's been retired from service. You bring another one in. Is there any conflict of interest, you know, between the two dogs? The first dog saying, hey, wait a minute now. I'm going to get into an emotional hang-up here or a problem or something. And sort of aside to that, I had another question. I'm going to throw it in right now. Is there any problem in having multiple trainers? And the reason I ask this is that I've been watching the neighbors across the canal here who have acquired a new bulldog, and they're going through training with that dog. And the wife does some training one day, and the husband does some training the next day. Is this defeating the purpose? Should it be only one trainer, or does multiplicity work? KY6V, and then pass it on, David. Thank you.
Well, all some very valid questions there. I also was going to address the other question you had asked me before about retraining. And yes, dogs can backslide and might need to be retrained. And that's one thing that they do enforce with Paws for Independence, the program I'm with. You know, they will bring a dog in for retraining if it's needed. You know, some programs, you know, once they pass it on to you, the handler, it's your dog, and do what you need to. So Paws for Independence will take and retrain a dog if they start to backslide. So as far as retraining, yes, there might be a need for retraining eventually. As far as conflicts, well, there could be some emotional conflicts, you know, depending on how much emotional attachment, which is why I said that's probably one of the hardest parts of having a service dog, is you got to consider that dog a working dog, not a pet. It's, you know, my dog Cole is not a pet. He is a working dog. He sleeps in his kennel at night. You know, he might be, if I'm laying down watching TV or something during the day, and he might crawl up with me and lay with me, but at night he sleeps in his cage. And he is, you know, definitely, you know, separated as a service dog, as a working dog that way. Allow me to reset here. So there might be some emotional attachment, and yeah, so you might have to retire this dog when they're becoming slow and not able to handle the tasks anymore. and here you got a fresh dog coming in, you know, what do you do with the retiring dog? Do you keep it as a pet? And you know, the dog might get upset watching you work with a new dog, or do you pass the dog on to somebody else as a pet? So, you know, it's all considerations at the time when it comes time for them to, as you said, put out the pasture. You know, when it's time for the retirement time, and that's a hard decision at that point. So hopefully is there anything else there, Gordon, before I pass it on to Glenn?
Yeah, just touch, if you would, on dual training. More than one trainer working on the same dog at the same time. Well, I shouldn't say the same time, but reasonably the same day or next day or whatever. Is that a complication? Over.
Well, as I said, a lot of agencies will train a dog, you know, take the year or two, whatever it takes to train a dog, then bring in the prospective handler and then train them for a few weeks together. So that's other trainers training this dog here at that point. Even at Paws for Independence, what we will do to help prevent things like separation anxiety and all that is we will switch handlers. So, you know, instead of me taking my dog around the room, I'll be taking somebody else's dog, and they'll be taking my dog. So there's no conflict with other trainers, you know, as long as you're all on the same training plan. You know, there's no conflict there. Like I said, we will actually switch dogs in our training. And so I said, you're handling their dog, and they're handling your dog. So hopefully that helps you there, Gordon.
Yeah, it gives me some support for the neighbors across the canal. They're doing it right. Thank you, David. KY6V, I'm set for the moment.
Okay, thank you. And we had M6GSN. Good evening to you, Glenn, the Werewolf of London. Come on ahead.
I just want to say good morning, David, and good morning to everyone else in the group. It is morning here. It is currently, just come up to 1 o'clock in the morning. David, I know this story, but just for the purpose for everyone else here, how did you and Cole get together? Can you tell us the story?
Well, I did kind of give a background history of how we got to the TIN here, as far as my getting involved with Paws for Independence and everything else. But the trainers are. I was working with other dogs. Now they work with a lot of boxers and Rottweilers at Paws for Independence. In fact, the head trainer breeds Rottweilers and boxers. So I was working with a number of different boxers there, training them, before I actually got my dog in August. And they were going to introduce me to a number of other dogs as prospective dogs for me. In August, on a Monday night, they told me that there was a possible black lab for me to meet up with. And so I went ahead and worked with the boxer I was working with on that Monday. That Tuesday, I got to class and I had to run home and grab something. When I got back, there was this other trainer, Allison, with my dog Cole standing there with her back to me. I said, "Hi, Allison, is that Cole?" She turned around and points him at me, and Cole walks over. And front paws in my lap, started kissing me right there and then. He kind of picked me. I didn't pick him. He picked me. And the rest is history. He's we bonded very well since then. Anything else here from you there, Glenn, before we move on? KB90WC.
No, that was it. Thanks. Like I said, I was just for the curious for the group's sake of the story of how you and Cole got together. Been very informational, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of the show. Back to you there, David. KB9EWG from M6 and GSN.
Well, thank you, Glenn. There's been some excellent questions and comments here this evening, and I appreciate it. Anybody else have any questions, comments, or just wish to check in before I move on? This is KB9EWG. Okay, nothing else heard. I'm going to move on with a little bit further from the rules here from the ADA. This covers inquiries, exclusions, charges, and other specific rules related to service animals. Okay, when it is not obvious what a service animal provides, only limited inquiries are allowed by staff. They may ask only two questions. One, is that a service animal required because of a disability? And two, what work or task is that dog trained to perform? Staff cannot ask about the person's disability, require medical documentation, require a special identification card or training documentation or for the dog, or ask the dog to demonstrate its ability to perform a work or task. And this area is where there's a lot of major confusion right now. There are a number of agencies out there. Let me reset. There are a number of agencies out there that you'll see on the internet that will, quote, register a service dog for you, unquote. You pay them $7,500 or more, and they'll provide you a certificate and an identification card and possibly a vest for your animal and say this is a service dog. And a lot of these agencies are committing fraud. This is not a service animal. If you read the documentation on these agencies, one thing that is required in there is you must have the animal trained. So you got an influx of people getting these fake identification cards and vests and everything, putting these vests on these dogs and saying they're service dogs, and taking them with untrained into different businesses and that, which is a really a problem for people who have trained service animals, because now you got these untrained animals coming into these businesses. They're barking, they're doing potty moves in the store. You know that they're just doing all these things that a service animal should not do, and you get a person with a legitimate service animal coming in, and they're going to have problems getting in because of the problems with these fake service animals. Also, there is laws on the book, and more states are cracking down more and more against these fake service animals, and you could be fined or arrested for this. Let me reset. So let me continue on with the definitions there. I just wanted to point on that as a point about identification and everything else that they cannot be asked for. Also, I carry a wallet card in my wallet with the rules of the ADA that I could show somebody if they have any questions in a store or something there. So. Once again, they cannot require you to show an ID or anything else. They're only allowed to ask you, is it a service animal, and what task does that service animal perform? Okay, let me reset. Continuing on, allergies and fear of dogs are not a valid reason for denying access or refusing a service to people using service animals. When a person who is allergic to a dog dander and a person who uses a service animal must spend time in the same room or facility, for example, in a school classroom or at a homeless shelter, they both should be accommodated by assigning them, if possible, to different locations within the rooms or different rooms in the facility. A person with a disability cannot be asked to remove his service animal from the premises unless, one, the dog is out of control and the handler does not take effective action to control it, or, two, the dog is not housebroken. When there is a legitimate reason to ask the service animal to be removed, staff must offer the person with a disability the opportunity to obtain goods or services without the animal's presence. Let me reset. Okay. Establishments that sell or prepare food must allow service animals in public areas, even if state or local codes prohibit animals on premises. People with disabilities who use service animals cannot be isolated from other patrons, treated less favorably or other than other patrons, or charge fees that cannot be charged to other patrons without animals in addition. If a business requires a deposit or fee to be paid by patrons with pets, it must waive the charge for service animals. If a business such as a hotel normally charges guests for damages that may be caused by a customer with a disability who may also be charged for damage caused by himself or his service animal. Staff are not required to provide care or food for a service animal. So that's some further definitions there. At this point, I'll look to see if anybody else wants you to check in or has any questions at this time. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net and talking about service dogs.
Six Victor,
go ahead.
Yeah, while you're on this tangent, David, I had one of the questions that came to me that sort of fits the subject that you're currently covering. What arrangements need to be made to fly with your service dog, you know, commercially? Does one need to purchase an additional seat? Or is the dog allowed to sit in your lap? Or is a carrying case required, et cetera, over?
That I don't have a whole lot of knowledge as of yet, as I've not flown commercial airlines myself. I do believe that, you know, and they do have separate rules under the Air Carriers Act, you know, with for service animals. I know there was recently a woman who was removed from a plane trying to bring her, quote, emotional support squirrel on board a plane when emotional support animals are not service animals, and under the ADA, you know, a squirrel is not a service animal. But that's a good question there, Gordon. I'd have to dig further, but as far as I know, a service dog should not require a separate ticket, or, you know, they should be seated with the handler, to the best of my knowledge. I don't have a whole lot of knowledge on this myself because I have not flown commercially myself. KY6V, KB9EWG.
Well, thank you for that, David. KY6V. I know, at least in the past, Kathy has flown with her cat on a number of occasions, and in that case, the cat had to be in a carrying a case, and that case had to be able to be fit underneath the seat. I'm just thinking of the situation, and I don't know the answer either, but maybe it'd be interesting to try and research it. If you don't have to buy an additional seat, you've got a 100-pound lab or a German shepherd, and it has to sit on your lap, and you got a 4-hour or an 8-hour flight, you're in trouble. Don't you think, David? Over.
Well, I would think there would have to be reasonable accommodations for a properly trained service animal. And as you pointed out, you know, on the webpage, training is what makes the difference. Training is what defines a service animal as a service animal. And while I'm on that subject here, I can probably go into some of the definitions also. Good thoughts, sir, Gordon. Anything else before I continue?
No, that'll do it at the moment. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
N6 NFF.
Okay, perhaps Doug there would know, because he's I've only had my dog since August, so I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge. But Doug has, his wife's had the dog a lot longer, so maybe he's got some knowledge on this. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. Where guide dogs for blind people are concerned, you don't have to buy an extra ticket, nor do you have to hold the dog in your lap. Guide dogs can lay on the floor right by the passenger that has the dog. What they do is, when guide dog schools know that a person is going to fly, they train the person on how to situate the dog in the airplane seat. As I say, the dog lays on the floor. Now, what Guide Dogs for the Blind has, they have a mock-up of an airplane seat, so they can actually train the dog, if they know the dog is going to fly, on how to get in that airplane seat on the floor, so that when the handler and the dog walk onto the plane, the dog knows exactly what to do. It is a bit uncomfortable, especially if you're talking about those four-hour flights. Now, Sheila's other dog, Betty Lou, came from Boring, Oregon, so they flew from Portland back down here to Sacramento, but that was only for a couple of hours. But it can be a little cramped for the dog if they have to lay in that kind of squatted position for 4 hours, but you do not need to pay for an extra ticket, at least where guide dogs are concerned. Let me reset the timer. Guide dogs always encourage their students to get a muzzle and to take that muzzle with them, whether they're flying home from the guide dog school or other types of flights, because the flight attendant does have the right to ask for the dog to be muzzled, and if he or she does ask, the handler must muzzle the dog. Sheila got a kind of muzzler called the gentle leader. It's a special collar that will give Sheila better control of her dog. She hasn't used it on Rufus because he doesn't like it and she doesn't feel it's needed. Her other guide dog, Betty Lou, had a gentle leader, and she absolutely hated it. She did everything she could to get that gentle leader off when it was placed upon her, but Sheila had trouble controlling Betty Lou, so that's why she had to wear the gentle leader in the latter days that her former dog was a guide dog. There was something else I was going to add. I had a friend in Columbus. She talked about the one dog becoming a pet and a newer dog taking over as the service dog. This was interesting. I had a friend who had a black lab. She retired the black lab and got a golden retriever. Every time, and she kept the black lab as a pet. Every time she went to harness up the golden retriever to go somewhere, the black lab would get up and charge forward as if to kind of say, "Hey, wait a minute, what about me? That's my job." For the longest time, the black lab couldn't accept the fact that she was no longer doing that her duties were transferred over to the golden retriever. That's all I've got, Dave, so I'll send it back to you. This is N6NFF.
Okay, well, thank you, Doug. And did you have some comments you wanted to make there? M6TSN, I see you put something in the text box there.
Yeah, well, sorry, what it was, at the time I was looking up things about service dogs on air. Apparently in the UK, Civil Aviation Authority, the UK version of the FAA, say that if you've got service dogs can travel in the cabin. If they're too large to fit on the floor, then a extra seat needs to be purchased for the dog to be comfortable in the space. Sit next to the dog owner. That's in the UK. I since found a web page which has information about American Airlines and their different views. We'll try and find a way of getting that onto the group. Problem is, I'm on my phone and it's on the computer. So I'll try and get that across somehow. But there is, yeah, there is information out there. Oh, actually, that's one of the service dog registration sites. So yeah, I'm not too sure how accurate that one is. But yeah, over here in the UK, it's a case of if extra space is needed, you've got to buy these seats. But I'm not sure about America. So back to you there, David, KB9EWG.
Well, thank you, Glenn. That's helpful information there. And gives us more food for thought. As far as, you know, the under the seats and everything else, that is one thing that we do teach our dogs. We teach them to what they call tuck. Tuck would be, you know, you're in a restaurant or at a picnic table or something, the dog is taught to tuck up under the seat or under the table. So they're out of people's path and everything else there. They are taught to tuck. And that's the command you give them, tuck, when you have them do so. I haven't... Cole is just starting. He hasn't really learned well yet on tuck. But I've got other things I am working with him on right now. Trying to get him to pass his CGC test. Which is an essential part of training. Okay, I'm going to see if there's anybody else with questions or comments before I continue on. This is KB9EWG. Okay, well, one thing I should probably touch on at this point, this is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net, talking about the training and use of service dogs. One thing that was mentioned a couple of times I should probably touch on further here is some of the definitions. There are a number of different types of dogs out there, and people are starting to confuse a lot of these different types of animals. You've got service animals, you've got emotional support animals, and you've got therapy dogs. Therapy dogs are dogs that would be trained with minimal training. I think one of the tests would be the CGC test, a good citizenship test, which I'll go into later. And they're trained in, and what they'll do is they'll put a vest on one of these dogs that says therapy dog. And these dogs can go into hospitals, nursing homes, and that to help comfort patients in these facilities. These are not individually trained dogs for the handler. These are trained dogs to comfort those who are in these facilities. There are emotional support animals, and people can go to these registries and register them and everything else. Now, if a doctor does prescribe a dog as an emotional support animal, you do have the housing regulations that they cannot be denied housing and everything else. That they have some of the same protections as service dogs, but these dogs do not have the public access of a service dog. And then there's the service dogs. The service dogs are trained to the person's individual disabilities. Like, I am a part-time wheelchair user, and my dog is being trained to assist with opening doors, retrieving dropped objects, and there's a long list of tasks I've got he's being trained to do, but those are a couple examples. Assisting with opening doors and retrieving dropped objects are two of the things he's being trained to do for me. As said before, service dogs do have access anywhere that the handler can go in public settings. But the service dog must be trained in how to behave and everything else in public and socialized. So that brings up the CGC, the Good Citizenship Test, which if you look on the webpage, there's a link to that. And let me reset here. The CGC is a test by the American Kennel Association, the AKC. And that consists of 10 tasks that they're trained to do in this test. Part of a dog having access in public as a service dog is they must pass this test. Currently, my dog Cole does not have full public access because he has not passed the CGC yet. I do have a vest that says service dog and training. And I do take him to places that are dog friendly, where dogs are allowed, and try to socialize him because they have to be socialized as part of passing their test there. But I've been working with him on a number of these tasks for the test, and he's doing well. But you know, it's going to take a few months before he actually takes and passes his test. Once he takes and passes his test, he will have full access with me to go anywhere at that point. But that's the essential thing, is passing that CGC test to prove that they are able to behave in public and around other animals and everything else there. That proves that they're able to do so, and that gives them the access that they have. Which is why emotional support animals don't have the same access, because they're not trained as such. Now, anybody could take the CGC test for their dog, and that will do things like give them insurance benefits and everything else as far as housing insurance. Especially if they got a breed that's known for biting and everything else, or they can get discounts if they have a CGC certificate from the AKC. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net. Anybody have any questions or want to check in this time? Okay, nobody with any questions here. So anyways, like I said, the CGC does involve 10 tasks. I'm just pulling this up here so I can give you the exact test. Okay, one is accepting a friendly stranger. Two is sitting politely for petting. Three is appearance and grooming. Four is out for a walk, walking on a loose lead. In other words, if you're out walking your dog, you know, he's not pulling or tugging. You keep a loose leash on him, and he's healing by your side. That's a important part of the test there. Walking through a crowd is test number five. Number six is sit down on command and staying in place. And this is one of the things that I'm working with my dog Cole on. I've got a 20-foot leash I take him with and go in a parking lot. You know, I have him sit, and I'll tell him to either stay or wait. If I tell him to stay, that means I'll go to the full length of the 20-foot leash and then wait a little bit of time. Then call him to me, and he'll walk to me, and then turn and sit down by my side in a proper heel position. Or if I tell him to wait, I'll take and go to the end of the whole leash, the 20-foot leash. And then I'll go back to him, and he must stay seated in a heel position until I get back and along his side there. So that's two of the tasks I'm working on right now with him, and he's really coming along and getting close to being very consistent with those two tasks there. Let me reset. So that's the test six and seven, the sit down and on command and staying in place. And test seven is coming when called. And they're saying it's 10-foot leash, 11, training him on the full 20-foot just to get him accommodated here. Test 9 is a reaction to distraction. So in other words, you, the handler, are walking with your dog, and the tester will make a distraction, a noise or something there to distract the dog. They're allowed to look around to see where the noise is coming from, but they must continue on their tasks, or, you know, walking with you in a proper heel position. So they are allowed to look around, but they're not allowed to walk away or try to go towards the distraction or whatever else. They must continue as such. And test number 10 is supervised separation. In other words, the tester will have the dog sit, and you walk away out of sight for 3 minutes, and then return and see how the dog reacts to that time there. So those 10 tasks are required for the dog to be able to have public access, in addition to what, you know, the tasks that the dog is trying to do. But before a dog has full public access, they must pass the CGC test. At least that's the way it is with the training program I'm involved with here. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net talking about service dogs. Anybody with any questions or wish to check in this time?
Six Victor,
go ahead.
Thank you, David. KY6V here. While you're on the training steps, I've got a question that maybe is a little bit on the dark side, and I hate to take the program that way, but nevertheless, it's life in real color. It's my understanding that the animals certainly can be house trained, potty trained, whatever you want to call it. I also understand from my reading that the dog can be trained to relieve itself, go to the bathroom, if you will, on command, which I think, you know, depending on the situation, is an excellent avenue for the owner and for the dog. I guess the question that I'm really pondering here, and I'm going to take you back to the airplane for a moment. You've got a dog that is trained when and when not to relieve itself. You're on a 4 or an 8 hour flight. There's some point that the dog is going to have to go. How does the owner handle that? All of us at one time or another, or most of us, I'm sure, have been in the lavatories, the bathrooms on an airplane. And if you can get a 100-pound dog and yourself in there, you're doing something. So, you know, how are things handled, or do you know, David? KY6V, over.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, training them to go on demand is part of their training. Cole is still very early in his training to teach him that step yet. I'm just trying to get him into the sets of the CGC right now. The good citizen, the canine good citizenship is what the CGC stands for. And I have had him in his vest and in a few different places there, and he has defecated in a hallway or whatever, and I do always have bags and I have wipes and sanitizer and everything else. I'm always prepared in case he goes somewhere he shouldn't. But yeah, I always try to make sure that before I go into somewhere that we always have a chance to go. And if he's in his vest comes off before he goes. It's just not as attractive seeing a dog in a service dog vest or a service dog in training, in his case, doing their duty with the vest on. So, but I have not been in a situation there on an airplane. And 8 hours is a long time to expect a dog to hold it without going, but I know that I do what I can to make sure he goes before we enter somewhere, and prepared in case there is a accident, should we say? And that's one of the problems with these fake service dogs. You know, people having dogs untrained in stores, lifting legs on merchandise and everything else. Not a good situation there, so, but he eventually will be trained to go on demand, as you said there, Gordon. KY6B, KB90WG. As far as on a plane, I have no experience, so I could not answer that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's some probably tricks of the trade. Some of my reading here recently, when we started the promos on the program, David indicated there are some things that can be done. You're talking about being prepared and having the necessary items to take care of the situation. I understand there's some things on the market imitation grass rugs, and they're small. I don't know, they're something like, I think the ones I were looking at was something like 20 inches by 20 inches, something like that. Looks like grass, feels like grass. It's sanitized material, it's absorbent material, etc., etc., that the dog can be trained to use. I can't quite envision trying to take a dog into an airplane lavatory and putting that down and being able to handle the situation comfortably, but I guess it's been done. Before you close out, you don't have to answer this now, but there's one other question. Let me buy a nickel. I've also been reading that a dog can be trained to call 911 during an emergency. And I think that's a neat thing. I don't know how it works. I wonder if you do. What happens? He can be trained to hit the button to get to 911. The dispatcher comes online. And what's the dog do next? Bark? Is the dispatcher trained to realize that if they've got an incoming call with a barking dog, that they've got a problem that they have to attend to? Or how does that work? Over.
Okay, the only knowledge I have of this so far is stuff I've heard from the class and everything else. They do have special phones that can be dog-friendly. Buttons the dog can press and if necessary, bark at the phone. I imagine if you're a 911 dispatcher and you got a dog barking at you on the phone there, and you're probably going to want to follow up on this. They also can be taught how to activate the personal emergency response system or PERS buttons. Like I have one on my neck here that if I push it, I'll activate a box in the other room that will place a call to a call center, and you know that's for help there. You've probably seen the commercials, help, I've fallen, I can't get up, and everything else. Well, dogs can be trained to activate those buttons also. And they actually have some buttons that can be mounted on a wall that you specifically press this button, and it will activate the PERS, or the emergency response system. So, yes, they can be taught to press the emergency buttons. In fact, Cole, I'm going to be getting, right now I've got mine on my neck, I'm going to get a wrist band for mine and move it to the wrist. Cole could be taught to press that in case I'm unresponsive. That is one thing perhaps he's going to be trained as. Or I can get one of the emergency buttons to mount on the wall for that system. Let me reset here. But as I said, they do have dog-friendly phones that a dog could activate by pressing a button and barking at it. They've also can be taught to dial specific numbers on this phone by pressing other buttons. Yeah, depending on the need and everything else. But yeah, they do have equipment available to allow a dog to be able to make these calls. So it is very, very true the case there, Gordon. Anything further from you? KY6B, KB9UWG.
Well, I think that's great. You know, you've broadened my thinking a little bit, David, in the respect that if they've got doggy phones, or however you want to classify it, that they can operate with the technology that we have available to us now, there can probably be a pre-recording that follows if it was 911, as an example, maybe some other special service. But if it goes to 911, once the call is answered, this recording comes on and said, this is a trouble call. I'm located at address, blah, 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 blah. Give all the particulars. And the dog doesn't have to say a word, I would think. I'm just guessing at this. Thank you, David. KY6V, over.
Yeah, as I said, I've never actually seen one myself, but you know, it's been discussed in class that there are dog-friendly phones that designed for dogs to be able to activate. And like I said, and also the emergency response button, like I have, they can be taught to activate that. One apartment building I was in had pull strings in the bathroom and the kitchen and that. And a neighbor of mine had a service dog that was trained to pull the string if she was unresponsive, which would ring a loud bell and would bring security in and all that there. So dogs can be trained to do this type of stuff. And as I said, the as far as the diabetes response, we've had demonstrations in class where this German Shepherd, you know, they take the swab that they swab this guy with, you know, when he's having his low, and hide this swab somewhere in the room, and the dog will seek it out. It's like a drug dog seeking out drugs. And sure enough, the dog would find the vial with the swab in there and respond. So it's amazing what these dogs can be trained to do. And I'm happy to be part of the program. It's very, very rewarding training these dogs here. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net. We are talking service dogs and training and use of them. Anybody else wishing to check in or have any further questions before I continue on?
Golf Sierra November.
Golf Sierra November. Go ahead.
Just my personal thought on the 999, or should I say 911 thing with the dog phone. I think if there was a service dog that was trained to do that, they probably would register their number on the 911 system. If there's a way of registering that, say, like if a call comes in from this and you get a dog barking at you, they say, yeah, an ambulance needs to be dispatched. So it like pops up on the dispatcher screen. That's just my opinion. Back to you there, David. KB9EWG from M6 GFN.
Yeah, that's a good point that you make there. That's that I would imagine somebody would do, though. That's good. That's good. The thought there, Glenn. This is KB9EWG with the Thursday Information Net talking the use and training of service dogs. Anybody else put any questions or comments before I continue on? Okay, another thing I'm going to touch on here is, why is it bad to pet a service dog? First of all, there's many reasons why. A person should never pet a service dog, should not distract the service dog, should not call the dog out. You never know what that dog is trying to do or what that dog is performing. That dog could be an emotional support dog, now there are service dogs that do support a person emotionally, like with PTSD or whatever. They can do what they call grounding, or they're trained to give deep pressure to assist the person through any anxiety attacks or whatever. These are not the emotional support dogs that people think of as just being a pet and it's there just for their comfort. These dogs are trained in specific tests to actually aid a person through, you know, like I said, stress or drama or whatever. But anyways, you never know what this dog is doing for their task. You know, it could be guiding a person through somewhere. You distract that dog while they're trying to guide this person, and all of a sudden the dog could wind up going on the wrong path and causing injuries to the handler or to your dog. So I said you should never approach a dog, distract it, call it, make whistles at it. You know, all this is bad practice around service dog, because that dog might be doing a specific task and you not realize, and you distracting this dog could pull this dog off its task. such as in case of a person with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, you just strike this dog and the person's having a panic attack or something, and the dog might not sense this because he's being distracted. So distracting a dog could cause injury or problems for the handler and the dog, as well as yourself there. So that's why it's never a good idea to, you know, approach a dog or try to pet a dog without permission from the handler. Let me reset here. This is KB9EWG. Gordon, did you have any more questions for this? Or we got about a half hour left if we're going to wrap this up about 8 o'clock. Well, actually, it'll be 9 o'clock your time, I believe. But anything else from you, Gordon?
Well, you know, I think I've just about run out of every question that was sent to me. There is one here that I'll throw out to you. This came into me with a question. Can people bring more than one service dog into a public place? You care to comment on that? Over.
Are you saying one handler and possibly two or more dogs?
Yeah, one owner that has a service dog. Can that owner bring two service dogs into a public place at the same time? And I've done a little research on that, if you're not familiar with it, over.
Well, first of all, I would think that could be difficult to be trying to handle two or more dogs at once there and keep them under proper control and everything else as service dogs there. What have you found in your research?
Well, what I found on the friendly internet was, yes, it is permissible. If the situation is that the owner has two different distinct problems, I don't know if you'd call them two disabilities or how that would be phrased, but two issues that are handled. Let's just give an example. One dog is a seeing eye dog because the gentleman or the lady is blind, but by the same token, the person is a diabetic, and the second dog is trained to take care of the diabetic side. From what I think that I'm understanding from the articles that I read on this, that under a situation like that or something similar, several dogs can be allowed into a public area. Over.
Okay, this is one thing I have not run into, but appreciate you're mentioning this. Yes, I could definitely see that as being viable. You know, if it's two different tasks trained to do two different dogs, and they're both, you know, proper service dogs. And as we've been saying all along, training is what makes a difference. Or they, you know, a trained dog versus a dog somebody goes out and buys a vest for and says it's a service dog. No. And those fake service dogs are really becoming a plague and a problem. One problem I will point out with a lot of these fake service dogs is somebody comes in with this ID they get issued from this quote-unquote service dog registry. They show it to a clerk at a store. Here I come along with my properly trained service dog. I don't have an ID because there is no such thing as an ID under the ADA. All of a sudden, this clerk says, you know, it does not allow me access. I don't have an ID, but the person before does have. And, you know, a lot of this fakery and fraud and everything else can really is really becoming a growing problem with a lot of these people. But as far as two, like I said, I can definitely see that being viable as far as they're both properly trained and everything else. Anything further, Gordon? KB90WG.
No, that's it from this end, but I want to thank you, David. I don't know, I guess he'd get into a big argument with his clerk that you were just referring to. You know, the other person shows the registration, you don't have one, you reach in your wallet and you pull out the ADA regulations that you've got in your wallet and says, read them. Thank you, David. KY6V, over.
That's exactly how I would handle that situation, you know. And these ADA cards are available just about anywhere you can get them, on even on Amazon. I've seen packs of 50 of those for $10. I have one that was given to me by Pause for Independence, and it's got the entire, you know, listing of all the ADA rules on there, including the two questions that can be asked of you. One is a service dog there to mitigate a disability, and two, what task is it trained to do? That's the extent of what they're allowed to ask. Everything else would fall under privacy and everything else act, you know, laws and other. But very good. One other thing I'm going to cover here before we wrap this up is I'm going to cover breeds, because there oftentimes people question, well, you know, what breeds can be service dogs. Anything further from you, Gordon, before I continue on?
Well, I was just going over the data that had been sent to me, David. There was one question that we didn't cover, and I don't know, you're sort of running out of time, but let me throw it at you, and we can cover it another time if you feel it's going to take too much. The question read, I have seen it mentioned that rewarding a misbehaving dog is better than punishing the dog. And it goes on to say that, case in point, when you find your dog chewing on your slippers, give the dog a treat or remove the slipper and put in place the dog's favorite toy. So I guess I'm asking you, what do you think about all of that? Over.
Well, first of all, you don't want to reward bad behavior. That would just encourage that bad behavior. You know, that's one of the things that comes out with the training. You never want to set up a dog to fail, but you don't want to reward bad behavior either. So, taking the slipper away and giving a treat, well, gee, if I chew on a slipper, I might get a treat again. You know, versus taking the toy away, or the slipper away and replacing it with a toy, that might be a possibility, but as far as rewarding bad behavior, that would never be encouraged. KY6V, KB90WG.
Yeah, I sort of share that thinking, too. But, you know, I guess I have to ask myself, David, I've, you know, was been raised with dogs. I've had shepherds and Dobermans and Rottweilers and so on and so forth through my life. I just love animals. but some people will, I hate to use the word punish. They'll try to redirect an animal by slapping them on the fanny with a magazine or a newspaper or something like that. Or some get violent and scream out the word no and so on and so forth. I would think some of that technique is detrimental to the dog in the long run. There's got to be a middle road somewhere, David. Over.
Yeah, well, about the most severe discipline I would do is I would put him in his cage. When I'm out training with him, he wears a prong collar. That's, you know, basically a choke type collar. It's got prongs that will dig in, but it's got a ring on there that keeps him from pulling too tight where it chokes him. But, you know, this is how they learn not to pull tightly on their leash there. And you can give them a quick snap of the prong collar to correct a action that they, you know, that they're not doing. And, you know, like if they're starting to get distracted by another dog or something, you'll give the leash a quick snap and tell them, ah, you know, a heel or whatever they're doing. That's about the extent of what kind of discipline you'll see with the training that I've been doing with him. Like I said, as far as taking the flipper away and rewarding with a treat, that just might encourage him to do that again. Taking the flipper away and maybe giving him one of his favorite toys, that might redirect him. Sending him to his cage, you know, that would be, you know, the most severe, but that I would, at least I would do. But, yeah, you never want to encourage bad behavior or reward bad behavior. That would just encourage more bad behavior. KY6B, KB90WG.
Well, we'll continue this conversation as the days go by. You know, I'm interested in learning a little bit more about the cage, sending him to the cage as punishment, and yet he is supposed to sleep in the cage at night. I'm having trouble with that one, David. KY6V, over.
Well, that is his quiet area. It's where he goes to seek solitude and where he sleeps. But, you know, if I need to discipline him, if he does wrong, I will send him to there also. But when he goes in there as disciplined, there, you know, there's nothing, you know, any toys or anything else in there are removed from there when that happens.
Well, that may be the key right there, too. Okay. Well, I want to thank you, David. It's been a great program. You realize that you've run this thing for an hour and 45 minutes. That's close to a record for the TIN. Over.
Well, I was going to touch briefly on breeds also, because people, I've had people asking about what kind of breeds, you know, a service dog can be. If you want me to wrap it up, I could, or I could give a small thing on breeds as well there.
No, you go right ahead, sir. I've got a terabyte or two down here also, over.
Okay, real good. Okay. So, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about breeds, common breeds for service dogs. Now, in the class that I teach at, we've had everything from Great Danes to Rottweilers, Boxers. The smallest dog I've seen in there is a Sheltie. You know, a Sheltie is like a miniature collie. And these are all service dogs in training. So the most common breed for guide dogs and mobility assistance dogs are Labrador Retrievers and Golden Retrievers. I myself have a Labrador. Service dogs range from very small to very large in size. The dog must be able to comfortably execute the tasks needed to help mitigate the disability. For example, a Papillon is not an appropriate choice to pull a wheelchair, but could make an excellent hearing assistance dog or emotional support dog. Increasingly, many service dogs are rescued from shelters. Okay, so many different, like I said, there can be many different breeds and sizes. The main trainer we've got, there, the head trainer, she breeds Boxers and Rottweilers, and a lot of these dogs are used for the service dog program. So I happen to have a black lab and just love the heck out of them. Anyways, I think if there's anybody else with any questions or anything else, we'll go ahead and wrap this up here. Anybody want to check in, have any questions or comments or whatever else at this time, come ahead, please. This is KB90WG. Okay, hearing nobody else, did you want to do the closing, or did you want me to go ahead and close it up there, Gordon? Gordon, did you want to close it, or did you want me to close it there? This is KB9EWG.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I almost missed that. I had stepped away from the equipment here for a short period. No, you go ahead and close it, and thank you very much, Dave, and I'll close down the recordings when you're set, KY6V.
Okay, real good. Well, this is KB9EWG. This has been the Thursday Information Net talking about the use and training of service dogs. This has been Scar's VoIP. Net schedules and general information may be found on the scarsvoip.com website. At this time, I'd like to thank KY6V for his assistance and questions, as well as others who had some good comments and questions for this year. Your net control station for this session has been David, KB9EWG, saying 7-3. Both in this VOIP session, this Thursday Information Net. Thank you for your participation. This net is now closed, and the equipment is returned to normal amateur use. 7-3, everybody. This is KB9EWG, and we are now secured.